Hello, gang, and welcome to another edition of National Bugle Radio. I'm your host, Patrick Slattery, and today we have back on the show Reverend Mark Bancroft. Mark is a very much sought-after commentator on a number of affairs. I'd like to talk to him about international affairs. We have this presidential election going on, and barely any discussion of the key international affairs, the key developments. There was a meeting of principals yesterday at the White House, cabinet members and high government officials who are involved in foreign policy and security, and they were discussing the bombing of the Syrian government in an effort to eliminate the government and kill the president of Syria. We know this from information that was revealed on the John Batchelor show on Tuesday evening, yet this is Thursday. If you look at the mainstream media, you don't find a word about it. All they want to talk about is Donald Trump's taxes. And to the extent there's any discussion, it's all nonsense and lies. The mainstream media is fine with that. And even a lot of the alternative media is really overlooking these important issues. But I know, Mark, you've been thinking about them yourself, doing research yourself, and also you have been following the discussion among those in the non-mainstream or mainstream who are talking about these issues. And in particular, we're talking about the real threat of a war between the United States and Russia that could happen pretty much any time. So, Mark, maybe you could start off with this chronology of this crisis in the new Cold War that has our Joint Chief of Staff chairman actually discussing the prospect of war with Russia.
Yeah, I don't know where to begin the chronology. Maybe I should begin with sources. You know, I would like to recommend for all of our people who, in fact, are listening to what we're saying here and to what David Duke and I said on the Rents Radio Network yesterday, October the 5th, and discussing some of these matters, to look at some of the best people and some of the best sources that are out there in both foreign and alternative media who have terrific credentials. And in this regard, I think the more people who listen to us, who consult these sources, the more that they will understand that you and I and David Duke and others are clearly on to something here in regard to the what is really transpiring and what is not being discussed by the mainstream media for very, very increasingly obvious reasons. I would urge people to consult Russia Insider on a daily basis. South Front is another terrific site to take a look. Those of you who, for example, are on Facebook and some of these social media sites can get South Front. They will send you their daily videos, which are absolutely professionally produced. I was looking at their Syrian war report of the 5th of October that came out yesterday. I'm sure that they will have a brand new one today. South Front also published an op-ed piece by the Saker, who many of you are familiar with. That op-ed piece is entitled Russian Options Against a U.S. Attack on Syria. Dr. Philip Giraldi of the Council for the National Interest, he is a former CIA station chief and analyst. Dr. Giraldi, of course, writes for Buchanan's American Conservative and for Antiwar.com. In addition to his work with the Council for the National Interest, this latest essay that he has out entitled Is Nuclear War Thinkable? Is must reading. Alter had a piece by Max Blumenthal yesterday entitled Inside the Shadowy PR Firm That's Lobbying for Regime Change in Syria. That is a critical thing to read. And then, of course, last but not least is the number of places on the net who carry for all of us the actual commentary of September the 22nd, where General Joseph Dunford, the Marine Corps general who is the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff.
Chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff.
Where he and defense. Yes, here you have a situation. We're on the September the 22nd. And this is a key date, by the way, because we had an agreement for a ceasefire negotiated by the U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry and the Russian Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov on the 9th of September. There were a series of things we can discuss that happened between the 9th of September and the time when General Dunford and Ash Carter appeared before the U.S. Senate Armed Services Committee on September the 22nd. And basically, when we actually contemplate what is said by both of these gentlemen on September the 22nd, a number of things are clear. One is that this so-called no-fly zone in Syria, which Hillary Clinton has called for, which her running mate, Mr. Kane, has called for, and ominously enough, the Republican vice presidential nominee, Mike Pence, called for openly in this so-called debate that he had with Timothy Kaine a couple of nights ago. This fly zone in Syria, to quote General Dunford at this point in his remarks on September the 22nd before the U.S. Senate Armed Services Committee, will mean war with Russia. Will mean war with Russia. Will mean war with Russia. Emphasis on what the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff has said here, which is not clearly the logical implication of all of this and the logical inference to be derived.
And why isn't this a headline in the news? Why don't people hear this?
Well, it's obvious that there is a deliberate collaboration of the American news media with the Zionist and neoconservative cabal that is running the foreign policy of the United States, that is deliberately downplaying or even eliminating references to any of this. For example, today someone sent me on Facebook, and I believe I sent this to you, Patrick, just in the last hour. Mm-hmm. You can take 1 minute and 54 seconds to actually see the United States Army Chief of Staff General Mark Milley openly threatening Russia and China, among others, Iran, North Korea, so forth and so on, openly threatening war with all of these countries and saying, boy, don't make any mistake about it. We're more powerful than you are. Mm-hmm. And if you continue to challenge our vital interests, which at least in this little clip, General Milley does not articulate what he believes those vital interests to be. I suspect his understanding of those vital interests is not necessarily what you and I would say is a vital interest, or Pat Buchanan or Paul Craig Roberts or Dr. Philip Giraldi or any of these other people. But nonetheless, the incredible overt saber rattling that the United States Army Chief of Staff engages in on YouTube for 1 minute and 54 seconds. Mm-hmm. And I believe Alex Jones posted this on InfoWars, which is where it came from. But nonetheless, we are looking directly at the general's remarks. It is absolutely breathtaking, the kind of irresponsible saber rattling that is going on here that merely puts the icing on the cake in terms of what General Dunford and Defense Secretary Carter were saying in more dispassionate tones September the 22nd.
I have a quick question. So General Milley was very, very belligerent. I saw that clip that you sent me.
Yes.
And Ash Carter may be more dispassionate, but we know from a variety of sources that he is very much part of this war party.
No question.
Now, what about General Dunford? Do you have any impression of whether he is really, is he reluctant about this, or is he as gung-ho as Milley?
My impression, and it's an impression, Milley seems to be the louder saber rattler than Dunford. Mm-hmm. I thought it was striking that in what Dunford did say on September the 22nd before the U.S. Senate Armed Services Committee, that he was basically explaining, in response to a question levied at him by Roger Wicker, the Republican U.S. Senator from Mississippi, that, well, Senator, Dunford says to Senator Wicker of Mississippi, you must understand that the imposition of a no-fly zone in Syria would mean war with Russia. And then General Dunford goes on to say something to the effect of, and I'm not prepared to go beyond that except to say that that's what it would mean. There are other people that would have to make that decision, quote unquote, or something to that effect. So that Dunford was basically explaining what it would obviously mean without saying overtly that he supported that as the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff. He was clearly going to defer to the President of the United States and what he and his cabal of foreign policy advisors decided was going to be the case in that country, Syria. And yet later, as you and I were talking off the air on this before we came on, later in that same September 22nd testimony, sworn testimony, that the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, General Dunford, and United States Defense Secretary Ash Carter are giving before the U.S. Senate Armed Services Committee, they go on, the record as saying that they will not follow, they will not implement certain things in a cooperative arrangement with Russia that the September 9th agreement between U.S. Secretary of State Kerry and the Russian Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov requires them to observe, because presumably the Secretary of State for the United States, acting with the complete authorization officially of the President of the United States, has entered into a deal on the 9th of September with the Russian Foreign Minister that has the complete imprimatur of the President of the United States and the United States Secretary of State. And here you have the Chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff and the United States Defense Secretary openly telling the U.S. Senate Armed Services Committee in sworn testimony that they're not prepared to implement what's in that deal of the 9th September, which, of course, may well explain all of the things subsequently happened that I believe are so suspicious in regard to this catastrophe of September the 17th. These U.S. airstrikes on Syrian army positions killed 90 people, wounded 100. That does seem to be coordinated, despite official United States Air Force denials, seems to be absolutely coordinated with an ISIS ground offensive against Syrian governmental troops in this battle for Aleppo. And that it's only 2 days after that that the United States embarrassed itself internationally with this, these outlandish airstrikes of September the 17th. It's on September the 19th that we then get this attack on a humanitarian aid convoy in Aleppo, that between the 19th of September and the 22nd of September, when General Dunford and Ash Carter testified officially before the U.S. Senate Armed Services Committee, the American media was spinning the tale with direct and indirect leaks from high-ranking government officials with no evidence whatsoever that Russia was responsible for this attack on this humanitarian aid convoy in Aleppo. And when one continues to see what continues to emerge out of that the 19th tragedy, I think that overall the circumstances suggest strongly that Russia had absolutely no motive to have done that, and that when we begin to look more at the film footage of the aftermath of this attack, it is entirely probable that that attack was not the result of an operation from the air, but was the result of an operation on the ground that was launched against that humanitarian aid convoy in an area that was under very strong ISIS and jihadic control. And yet, when you get back then to September the 22nd, you have the official statements of the United States Chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff and the Defense Secretary of the United States that they don't have the facts on what happened on September the 19th with this attack on this humanitarian aid convoy. They are more than happy. They've not said that to the media, right? They're more than happy to have the media spinning the tale in the United States that the Russians did this. But let me read from a transcript of this, and part of this is analysis of it. Let's go directly to the testimony itself.
Okay.
The U.S. position that Russia did this was reflected in the testimony of both General Dunford and Defense Secretary Ashton Carter before the U.S. Senate Armed Services Committee on Thursday, September the 22nd. The General Dunford, admitted to the committee, quote, "I don't have the facts as to what planes carried out the attack," but then he quickly added, quote, "There is no doubt in my mind that the Russians are responsible," unquote. And then that's followed by the United States Defense Secretary Ash Carter declaring, quote, "The Russians are responsible for this strike, whether they conducted it or not," unquote.
This is just
insanity.
You know, you think that just 2 days earlier, the United States bombed the Syrian army, and then said, oh, it was an accident. Well, if you think it, really believe that was an accident, I've got a USS Liberty story I'd like to sell you. But
Exactly.
They claim that their intelligence is so bad that they couldn't even tell that that was the Syrian army and went on this. It wasn't just one errant bomb. This is a prolonged attack. And then 2 days later, somehow their intelligence is so great that they can say that this was a Russian Air Force that bombed a convoy where they would have absolutely no motivation to do so.
Exactly. Whereas on the 17th of September, this convenient accident by the United States Air Force providing airstrikes for an ISIS ground offensive against Assad's troops that were doing quite well in Aleppo up to that point underscores the absolute motive of the United States to do this deliberately, because when we piece together the events of the last 5 years, 5.5 years in Syria, there is no question that the United States government seeks regime change in Syria. Mm-hmm. This is the Israeli policy. This is the policy of the neoconservatives. This is the policy of the Project for the New American Century and its Foreign Policy Initiative successor organization. This is the policy of the American-Israel Public Affairs Committee. This is the policy of the government that engaged in illegal use of NATO in Libya to facilitate regime change in that country, extrajudicial assassination of the head of that country's government with the open support and open laughter of Hillary Clinton, the Secretary of State of the United States at that time, and that subsequently all of the evidence is there.
Yeah.
That these Wahhabic, Sunni Wahhabic extremists that we helped facilitate coming to the influence that they have in Libya and helping us to get rid of Gaddafi by termination with extreme prejudice, right?
Right.
Where we had these surrogate murderers on the ground that engaged in this man's open and brutal assassination. But subsequently, both in terms of men and arms and money, that these jihadic extremists in Libya were being funneled into Syria.
Yeah. Okay.
This is what was really behind the Benghazi thing in the terms of the eventual violent death of this U.S. ambassador there, Stevens.
Right.
He was helping the CIA.
And I want to go there, but before we go there, what you've laid out is so huge. This is monumental, and I want it to sink in with people. So I just want to recap. So we had President Obama and John Kerry. I guess Obama doesn't want to go into history as the president who started World War III, or I think he just wants to kind of ride out his term. He had sent Kerry to meet with Lavrov to negotiate some sort of cooperation between the United States and Russia in Syria in combating ISIS. They come up with this ceasefire agreement, and at the end of the ceasefire agreement, there's supposed to be intelligence sharing on ISIS and some sort of cooperation on fighting ISIS. It's a one-week ceasefire. The ceasefire is basically destroyed, undermined and destroyed by this U.S. attack on the Syrian army, which, as you're pointing out, really was not just some isolated attack, but it seemed to be in coordination with an ISIS ground offensive. And then 2 days later, this attack on a UN aid convoy to Aleppo, which without any evidence whatsoever is being blamed on Russia. Even if Russia had nothing to do with it, it's Russia's fault, in the words of Ashton Carter. Then a couple days later, you have in sworn testimony, Ashton Carter, the defense secretary, and General Dunford, the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, explicitly telling the Senate in sworn testimony that they're not prepared to implement the terms of an agreement that the Secretary of State, upon the president's instructions, has negotiated.
I read a quote to support that last
Please do.
Point.
So this is from the transcript?
Yes. This is General Dunford on September the 22nd, sworn testimony before the U.S. Senate Armed Services Committee, asked if he supported the proposal for intelligence sharing agreed to by John Kerry and Sergey Lavrov on the 9th of September. Dunford responded, quote, keep in mind, folks, open testimony under oath before the United States Senate Armed Services Committee, our chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, responding in this forum under oath, says, quote, "We don't have any intention of having an intelligence sharing arrangement with the Russians," unquote.
Now, correct me if I'm wrong, but if his commander, the commander-in-chief, instructs him to share intelligence with Russia, and he refuses, isn't that mutiny?
Yes, and to me, this is exactly the point. This is mutinous behavior. This is treasonous behavior. And my father, just to underscore this, was a United States Air Force colonel, 32 years on active duty. He was in the most secretive division of Air Force intelligence for about 12 years during the height of the Cold War when I was a young boy. I had no idea in those days what he did. But I know what he would say because we discussed it many times over the years. And my dad was one of these senior Air Force officers who went through the Air War College system at Maxwell Air Force Base, Montgomery, Alabama, many years ago. That's now called Air University. The most elite officers of the United States Air Force go and study there for at least a year, dealing with policy and foreign policy and all kinds of integration of their military training with politics, diplomacy, international discretion in diplomacy, and everything else. My father, undoubtedly, if he were alive today and were reading this transcript, would say, you know, this guy needs to be officially reprimanded by the President of the United States. He should be asked openly to take back those public remarks that he made, not just to some news reporter. He said these things under oath
right
before the United States Senate Armed Services Committee. This guy should be defrocked. This guy, at a bare minimum, should be immediately demoted at least one star and summarily at least prematurely retired from the United States Marine Corps. He should lose his position as the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff. And if he doesn't take the remark back, he should be court-martialed.
Right, right. And, you know, there should be an investigation because what he was saying, you know, he was saying that they would not do this. I guess that's a conditional or kind of future prospect. But if indeed he has not been carrying out the instructions of his commander, that's mutiny. I'm not a proponent of the death penalty, but I have looked at the penalty for mutiny. The penalty for mutiny can be the death penalty. And we first heard about this through maybe a New York Times article, things that might have been said to the New York Times. But now he's on record in sworn testimony before the U.S. Senate. This is a real big deal. So there you have the military and the civilian leadership of the military in open mutiny against the President of the United States. Not somebody we terribly respect, but nevertheless, that's...
The President of the United States, but let's take it one step further. Just to put into context the level of lawlessness and anarchy that is going on here, for all of these neoconservative Zionist fanatics that are running this country's foreign policy, a foreign policy that is not simply the foreign policy of the Israeli government and the Israeli lobby industry in the United States and all of these Israeli agents in the American foreign policy and governmental and media apparatus, but the so-called Christian right in the United States, predominantly in the Republican Party, cheers this same sort of militarism on and is all enthralled over these outlandish remarks that Mike Pence made a couple of nights ago on national television supporting the idea of a no-fly zone with Syria, even though the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff has already officially testified before the U.S. Senate that this would mean war with Russia. And is this being played up in the media? Should this not be the core issue in these debates between Trump and Clinton? Should this not be the issue that is being talked about in all of these talk shows on CNN and Fox and on all the AM radio stations around the United States? This is largely going on completely under radar, as the events of just the last 5 years alone have been conducted in Syria, have been conducted completely under radar. And last but not least, in terms of the President of the United States, Has anyone asked him at a press conference what congressional declaration of war, constitutionally, Article 1, Section 8 of the Constitution, when did the United States Congress declare that we were at war with Syria? That's number one. And for people that get bent out of shape about the UN and all of this multilateral cooperation, all these other things, what UN Security Council resolution authorized anything that the U.S. is now doing in that country, either in terms of airstrikes? Obviously, the most compelling inside information that's being produced is that right now we have somewhere between 4,000 and 5,000 American intelligence and special operations people on the ground in Syria. And last but not least, why does it continue to escape the attention of this controlled news media, vast percentage of the American people, that the so-called perpetrators of 9/11, that the government and the media is telling us did 9/11, Al-Qaeda, right? Mm-hmm. Sunni Wahhabic Al-Qaeda. Why are we now working with Al-Qaeda, both in Libya and in Syria, to overthrow the legitimate government of that country, whether we like that government or not, and to be employing what we are employing covertly on the ground in that country in regard to black operational people and American military personnel in that country? And now, lo and behold, we have the United States Air Force undertaking airstrikes in that country, which are conveniently, in this latest tragedy of September the 17th, clearly and deliberately aimed at the Syrian Arab army of the legitimate government of that country, President Assad's army, against the worst elements in this Sunni Wahhabic extremist, these various Al-Qaeda and Al-Qaeda front organizations and ISIS that we are full partners with. These people that got into Syria got there from where? They got there from Libya. They got there from a CIA base in Jordan on the Jordanian-Syrian border that was being used to launch these Sunni Wahhabic people and get them into Syria. And last but not least, our so-called faithful NATO ally, the Turkish regime led by Mr. Erdogan, much as we were introducing these Al-Qaeda and ISIS elements into Syria from Libya, from a CIA base on the Jordanian-Syrian border. So we were also doing in full complicity with Erdogan in Turkey, who is allowing these Sunni Wahhabic extremists to cross into Syria from Erdogan's country, keeping in mind that Turkey is a so-called NATO ally. And then, of course, much has been revealed about all of the oil tanker traffic that had been going on, where ISIS was, in fact, trading with the Turkish regime with stolen Syrian oil, and driving these tankers into Turkey, selling the oil to an oil company largely controlled by Erdogan and son, principally his son, and that some of that oil was later even brokered to Israel. And Serena Shim, who was murdered, I believe, by the Turkish government in October of 2014, was a Press Television Iran correspondent on the ground on the Syrian-Turkish border. She was threatened several times overtly by the Turkish government before her death just several days later. She broadcast something to this effect on the air. She reported this to her superiors at Press Television in Tehran. Within a couple of days, she dies in a very, very mysterious vehicular mishap, driving away. She was being driven, I believe, by someone else, driving away back to her hotel, where there was subsequently a collision with a truck who pulled out from a side road or whatever, and it had the same ring of conspiracy as this rather convenient death of Vladimir Putin's chauffeur had in Moscow several months ago. So you had this all taking place, in my view, largely because Ms. Shim, who was a Lebanese-American, Her mother lives in Michigan. This poor woman, Serena Shim, left several small children behind. She was engaging in international TV reporting about all of these trucks that were leaving these ISIS-controlled areas on or close to the Syrian-Turkish border, that there was oil in these tankers, and that clearly the Turkish government had to be in complete complicity with ISIS over this.
Okay. Wow. So Turkey is completely cooperating with ISIS. This is not news to most of our listeners. Of course, Turkey and the United States are in the NATO alliance together. There's, for the most part, there seems to have been a great deal of cooperation between the United States and Turkey, that attempted coup against Erdogan. To me, it looked just like perhaps the United States was trying to get rid of Erdogan, because Erdogan's very, very, I don't know if wily is the word, but he's perhaps very undependable, and it looked for a little while like he might start cooperating with the Russians. And that's, he seems like the type of person who would switch sides and switch sides back again. And
yes.
And it seems to be the case. I for a little while it looked like he was switching sides and going to cooperate with the Russians, but now right back to being basically ISIS's main backer, and the main way that the United States is able to funnel support to ISIS.
Yeah, and it may well be that Erdogan got to looking at his situation after his government pulled the stunt of shooting down Russian Su-24 that was not even in Turkish airspace at the time. And that when that happened, that then seemed to produce a series of events, including Russian sanctions on Turkey, especially against Turkey's tourist industry, that started hurting Mr. Erdogan's pocketbook quite a bit. Between that and the fact that perhaps Erdogan is enough of a slippery eel politically, and this is what your commentary suggests, and I believe it too, that Erdogan was starting to see the United States get really bogged down in Syria, was starting to see the United States pushing the envelope with its support of this coup d'etat in Ukraine in February of 2014, and that the United States' actions in Eastern Europe as it relates to NATO and American missile batteries and all the rest of it was going to have Turkey potentially in the middle of the soup.
And also
something
United,
happened.
And also the support for Kurds in Syria,
exactly,
who are allied to the Kurds in Turkey that he fears so much, because there's so many
exactly.
Kurds in Turkey.
Yeah. So he was less than thrilled when the United States began using Kurds once again for their own purposes. There's an old history to this, by the way. We have a very utilitarian relationship with these Kurdish nationalist groups. We support them and we undermine them as they're serving our interests, as we have defined those interests in the previous 5 minutes. But Erdogan clearly was far less than thrilled with the American use of these Kurdish nationalists in Syria in ways that were going to come back on him, in terms of his desire not to in any way facilitate the potential development of a separatistic Kurdish country anywhere near his own country, much less on his southern and southeast border. So, yeah, that was also in play in regard to Erdogan's sudden conclusions, perhaps, that this cozy relationship with the United States and NATO was maybe not having the utility that it once had for him.
Earlier, I had interrupted you when you were just tying Libya into what's going on in Syria. And everybody probably remembers seeing that footage of Hillary Clinton cackling and saying, "We came, we saw, he died," when Huma Abedin had come up to her while she was about to start a televised interview. And that's why it's on video. But Huma Abedin had come up and showed her some evidence of Gaddafi's brutal murder, and she cackled. I don't know why Donald Trump doesn't put that in commercials, but there's a lot of things I don't understand about the way that campaign's run. But at any rate, could you go back and tie in Libya and the murder of Muammar Gaddafi into what's going on in Syria, as well as the Benghazi episode?
Yeah, I think in terms of Libya, there are a number of things that are very obvious. First is this. Why was NATO used to illegitimately invade Libya? Has it escaped the attention of people, including the current commanding general of the United States Army, that NATO had one statutory purpose that was agreed to when the United States Senate ratified the deal for NATO to be created and for the United States to be a part of it. It was to defend Western Europe from an invasion by the old Soviet Union, which no longer exists. Now, this General Miley, I believe his name is General Mark Miley, who made these totally jingoistic remarks in this YouTube thing that we talked about earlier, Patrick, he made reference to all these people that wanted to undermine NATO. He conveniently did not mention all the America First nationalists, all the American conservatives of great prominence who are anti-communist, but who are not globalists, who are not Zionists, who are not interventionists anywhere in the world, advocates, as this general is apparently, who think we ought to be out of NATO and should have been out of NATO a long time ago. We have seen in a number of instances, of which the Libyan thing is perhaps the most obvious, and now Syria, that NATO is being used as a global police force for the New World Order, for the global order, that our policymakers, these neoconservative, globalist, Zionist types, believe should be imposed on the entire world, or at least that portion of the world that we insist must accept our conditions in order not to be undermined and subsequently annihilated. And in terms of Libya, I think there were several things going on here. One, the French very much wanted to get rid of Gaddafi, for their own purposes. We won't stay with that one too long for purposes of time. The United States neoconservative and Zionist element decided that they wanted to get rid of Gaddafi. That had been something that was to their liking for a very long period of time. And last but not least, it's now emerged to my satisfaction, this has been proven to be factual, that Gaddafi, who had a very large gold reserve, was desirous of creating a Libyan currency, I believe it was called the dinar, or would have been called the dinar, that would have enabled Libya to conduct all of its oil business and oil transactions in a very viable currency other than the American dollar. And for all of those reasons, it was decided that Gaddafi had to go. And lo and behold, NATO is illegitimately employed once again with no original statutory authority whatsoever to go in there and to depose this guy in conjunction with obvious cooperation of these Sunni Wahhabic extremists, the worst types of Sunni Wahhabic extremists, with both NATO and the United States, in what subsequently became the public assassination, extrajudicial assassination, without one degree of what we would consider to be a legal standard, a international tribunal being employed or anything of the sort. Mr. Gaddafi ends up, as I recall, being sodomized with a knife while the cameras are running and being brutally tortured and killed in a most heinous, barbaric fashion. And that the response to the Gaddafi murder on the part of the then Secretary of State Hillary Clinton is to laugh, and as she's laughed and gloated more than once, "We came, we saw, he died," quote unquote. Well, let me tell you, this is along with some of the behavior of these American military officials recently has been the height of frightening public. They're not even masking the illegalities and masking the arrogance and masking the barbarism. There is an open attitude on the part of these types of people, including Mrs. Clinton, that the United States government, in the interests of the types of people who are disproportionately backing Hillary Clinton for the presidency of the United States, can do whatever it decides it wants to do anywhere in the world at any time and be as lawless and as vicious and as murderous as it chooses to be, irrespective of the U.S. Constitution or international law or the U.N. Security Council or anything else. And, of course, the what has happened in Libya since then, in terms of all of the destabilization of that country within that country as a matter of record, the utilization of these key Sunni Wahhabic elements in terms of having helped the U.S. and NATO to get rid of Gaddafi, to murder Gaddafi for the reasons we've just discussed and have articulated here, they subsequently move on with the full backing of the United States and Israel, the full backing of the Western NATO powers and the full backing of the Saudi Arabian government, the government of Qatar, and the government of Turkey, full backing for what has been going on in Syria since then. And if we want to get into the whole business of death totals, these actions conducted illegally, reprehensibly, immorally, and unconstitutionally by the United States government in Syria, Syria alone, not to mention our so-called Israeli allies and our Turkish allies and our Saudi allies and our Jordanian allies and our Qatar allies. These murderous actions have resulted in the deaths of 450,000 Syrians. Literally half of that country has been displaced. Infrastructure and homes destroyed. Half of the population of that country is now homeless. Mm-hmm. And out on the quote-unquote street, if you want to put it that way.
And created the pretext for this massive invasion of Europe by so-called migrants, who are mostly not Syrian, but this was the pretext for it.
Exactly, and of course David Duke, in this little clip that he played on his show on Rents Radio yesterday, where I was the guest, produced this clip of this Jewish rabbi in Europe that was saying it was absolutely wonderful that the Jews... Europe were in complete fellowship or alliance, as it were, with all of these Middle Eastern migrants, in that they were full partners and allies in the deliberate targeted demographic change that is obviously underway in Europe that only can have one target. As I said on Duke's show yesterday, can only have one target, and that is whatever vestige is left of the older white European, largely culturally Christian element that once comprised what we knew as Europe. So this starts getting into a whole other set of issues, and that is the targeted use since 1965, the targeted use of immigration patterns and immigration changes of law. I'm referring to the United States government's adaptation of the 1965 Immigration Reform Act here, that when you start looking at the way all of this has played out, there is another development that is a demographic development that is clearly involved in all of this, and that is the demographic destruction and eradication of what we once knew as the Western world, both in Europe and in the United States, with the full intent, deliberative intent, of this global New World Order, Zionist cabal, which is trying to impose its will around the world, using whatever methods it has to use to create a world government. That is what is behind all of this, ultimately. And in terms of endgame, it all begs the question as to how much longer it's going to be before a very proud Russian people and Russian nation, with a very shrewd president and foreign minister, decide in conjunction with the Russian military that they will take the quiet steps necessary to defend themselves against the kind of regime change activity on the part of the New World Order that is clearly represented by what happened in Libya, represented by what has happened in Syria, and what these people intend to do to the Iranian people and to the Iranian nation, and for that matter, what is now the full intent of the New World Order, both in Ukraine and in Eastern Europe, and ultimately to target Russia itself. It has been targeted, and these attacks are going to be economic. We've already seen some of that with these various sanctions. The cultural targeting of Russia via LGBT subversion has been responded to somewhat by official Russian actions that have booted these George Soros-related NGOs out of that country. But they'll keep trying, of course, as they do globally. And then, of course, ultimately, and most frighteningly, these latest noises coming out of Hillary Clinton, latest noises coming out of Mike Pence, the Republican vice presidential nominee, these latest noises of General Milley and General Joseph Dunford and Ash Carter and all the rest of them suggest that this is about to be a pushing of the military envelope as well. And to that I say good luck, because you people don't know what you're getting us into.
Okay. You know, you mentioned the 1965 Immigration Act, and I do think it's important to tie this together with the refugee situation.
Yes.
I just happen to have, right next to me as we're doing this, my autographed copy of Eugene McCarthy's book, A Colony of the World. Now, Eugene McCarthy was a senator best known for running for president as an anti-Vietnam War candidate in 1968. He, in 1965, was one of the co-sponsors of this Immigration Reform Act. In this 1992 book he wrote, it's kind of a mea culpa, and he's explaining why he mistakenly supported this bill, because he's coming down against immigration. He writes, many conservatives in Congress, however, and it's worthy of noting that Republican conservatives voted for this. It was mostly the Democratic conservatives from the South, the Dixiecrats, who were really the only force against the act. But he says, many conservatives in Congress feared that these changes would lead to a deluge of third world immigrants and eventually present a threat to the dominance of European culture in the United States. To assuage their concerns, Michael A. Fahan, the chairman of the House Immigration Subcommittee, amended the proposed legislation to ensure that the two top immigration preference categories were set aside for people with family connections in the United States. So it was originally written in such a way that people were worried about the change in the demographics of the United States. That was the original intent. There was, and this is me recapping now, there was an amendment made. So the amendment gave most of the immigration, made sure that most of the immigration would be for people with family connections in the United States. Well, if you had a country that was mostly European ancestry, family connections, one would assume, would be people with family connections to European Americans. So it would not change the demographic balance of the United States. But this is why you needed to have all of these refugee crises. So starting with Cuba and Vietnam and Cambodia and then Somalia and all these places, you had all these refugee crises, and refugees were able to pour into the United States. And then they were the ones who had the most immediate relatives to bring in under family reunification. Because maybe there might still be some Italian immigrants, but rather than an Italian immigrant bringing in cousins or second cousins from the old country, you had Somalis who had wives and children and brothers and sisters and mothers and fathers to bring in. So this is what totally flipped around what was the supposed intent of the law. So the law was amended to make it supposedly demographically neutral. But by exploiting this refugee situation, by having special immigrations for refugees, and of course Jews, you had the whole Jackson-Vanik Amendment to an omnibus trade bill that allowed Jews to come in as refugees without even having to show any type of personal persecution or threat to them. They were just a class. They were just a refugee class or a political asylum class. So that is the way this law was transformed into something that could demographically completely change the United States. So I just wanted to bring that in. Now, while we still have a little bit of time, you did bring in Mike Pence. We have the second presidential debate coming up on Sunday. And it's not that I have great expectations for it, but there's one thing that I think is a little bit interesting. There's going to be two moderators. One is Anderson Cooper. We're all familiar with him. And then the other is this Martha Raddatz. And I believe she's from CBS News. I never watched CBS News, so she wasn't somebody familiar to me, except that it was a New Hampshire Democratic primary debate with Hillary. I believe Martin O'Malley was still in the race at that time because it was before New Hampshire, and Bernie Sanders. And she's the only person at any of these debates who ever raised the question about this no-fly zone. And Hillary had stated her support for a no-fly zone, and Martha Raddatz said, if you have a no-fly zone, doesn't that mean shooting down Russian planes? She's the only person who's asked that. And Hillary says, well, I don't think I need to answer that question. Well, Martha Raddatz didn't press her on it, but she does need to answer the question. Martha Raddatz, will she ask Hillary about this no-fly zone, especially when it's in the news right now? That's what I want to know. Now, Martha Raddatz, there's no reason to have a great deal of faith in her. Her first husband was Ben Bradley Jr., the son of the Jewish editor-in-chief of the Washington Post, and then her second husband was also Jewish. She's on a third husband, and I don't know what his background is. I don't know what her background is, other than she's from Idaho, not Brooklyn, but that's a little bit interesting to me. So, Mark, I don't know if you want to comment on the prospects for the debate.
Sure, I can do that very quickly. I find it striking that in terms of the Pence-Kaine debate, that to some extent the Washington Post was agreeing with both David Duke and me and what we said yesterday on the air on October 5th on Rents Radio, that Pence pretty much carried the day vis-a-vis Kaine. But the thing that was so pleasing to the Washington Post was that Pence undermined so many of the head of his positions on Russia and on Middle Eastern policy and Syria and Putin and so forth and so on. Now, I mention this because that's very suggestive that the Washington Post thinks that's a terrific development. It is going to be harder for Donald Trump to handle some of these foreign policy questions and to say the things he should obviously say when the first thing it's going to be brought out if Trump chooses to really press on some of these issues, that should be his strategy. And yet, based upon what his vice presidential running mate did 2 days ago, it's going to be harder to launch that sort of effective attack when his own running mate has largely undermined mm-hmm. Trump on national television. Mm-hmm. So that's the first thing I would say about this debate. The second thing I would say is that I think the Trump people have been incompetent in negotiating the terms of these debates in terms of format, in terms of moderators, and in terms of this whole business of podiums being arranged and positioned and so forth. And last but not least, even the fact that apparently there was collusion between the Democratic candidate for the presidency of the United States and Lester Holt of ABC News in the first debate in regard to information in folders changing hands between Holt or Holt's people and Clinton's people that were on her podium during the initial conversation with Mr. Trump.
I'm not aware of that. What happened? What happened?
Yeah, what happened there? We don't know, but it certainly makes one wonder. And last but not least, I'll say this about Trump. Does anyone really believe that if Pat Buchanan had been in that first debate with Hillary Clinton, that he would have failed to skewer her? And Pat Buchanan, of course, with his media savvy and his background in forensic debate, basically would have been able to turn the tables on Lester Holt of ABC News and say, you know what, Lester, I think it's interesting that you're saying X, Y, or Z that you're asking of me here. How does that compare with what you ought to be asking my opponent mm-hmm. about A, B, and C? And clearly the core issue should have been for the Trump campaign, in my view, the core issue should have been foreign policy. The core issue should have been, do we really want a war with Russia? The core issue should have been, what did we really do in Libya? What are we really doing in Syria? How much longer can we bark up this same tree before we create an absolute catastrophe for ourselves and the world? That is clearly what should have been thrust of these Trump efforts and these debates from the beginning. It's now going to be a lot harder to do that, mm-hmm. not only because he stumbled in the first debate, but now his own running mate, it seems to me, with all of his neoconservative pro-Zionist rhetoric in this conversation with Mr. Kaine a couple of nights ago, has largely given the Democrats and Mrs. Clinton and the establishment media the obvious hammer to beat Trump over the head with. Trump goes too far in really pressing the envelope on this foreign policy and war issue, as he clearly should have in the first mm-hmm. debate.
Yeah, there's no question that Donald Trump doesn't have the type of background and skills to make an argument the way somebody like Pat Buchanan would have been able to. But, of course, Donald Trump is the one person with the financial and media resources to do an end run around this yes. Jewish establishment. So we have to be thankful for him, do all we can for him. He's got a lot of shortcomings, but you know.
And I will vote for him. I have to because of the alternative. There are a number of critical issues about Trump that are raised with me by colleagues who will not vote for him, who will either not vote or will support a third-party candidate. And I've simply said, look, this time around, I have to risk the vote for I haven't voted for a Republican president in a general election since 1988. Mm-hmm. I have voted for third-party candidates consistently from 1992 onward. But we are now in a situation where the strategy that you are urging upon me and upon other people is going to lead to the election of Hillary Clinton as president of the United States. Do you really want to be a party to that? And at the end of the day, say, no, I don't and won't be a party to that. And however badly I think Trump's campaign has been run up to this point, the frustrating character of his performance in the first debate with Mrs. Clinton, the clear problems with some of what his running mate said against Mr. Cain a couple of nights ago, I acknowledge all of that. And yet I personally feel that I have no choice but to vote for Trump. I voted for him in the GOP primary here because of all of the over neoconservative Zionist type candidates that were in those Republican presidential primaries. Trump was the only option for me as a Buchanan conservative. And he's the only option, I think, for people of our ilk now on November 8th. Much as I would like to have Pat Buchanan in there, much as I would like to have some of our other revered people on the paleo-conservative right in there who could do a very, very credible job, they don't have Trump's money. They're not in a position to do the ultimate end run around all of these forces aligned against them. Buchanan, as good as he was, couldn't do it in 92 and 96 because of the money. Now we're in a situation where, like it or not, I'm afraid Trump is our only chance.
He's our only chance.
Yes.
Okay. Do you have anything you want to add to that, or should we just wrap it up?
Well, I think we can wrap it up. I would simply urge people once again to consult South today, their reproduction of this article by The Saker, Russian Options Against a U.S. Attack on Syria. Please take a look at that article.
That's South Front. South Front.
South Front. And sign up, those of you who have YouTube, sign up for South Front and its daily war reports, video war reports out of Syria. I saw the one yesterday, the Syrian war report of 5 October. I look at those every day. There's a lot of tremendous information in them. And then last but not least, folks, take a look at the remarks of September the 22nd, on the record remarks of our chairman of our Joint Chiefs of Staff, General Joseph Dunford, and our U.S. Defense Secretary, Ash Carter, in regard to what they said to the United States Senate Armed Services Committee about the Syria no-fly zone, what they said about the ceasefire agreement of September the 9th, negotiated by our Secretary of State John Kerry, and the incredible things that were said both by Dunford and Carter in regard to the events of September 17th and 19th, just prior to the testimony of these two gentlemen on September the 22nd. It will be breathtaking, and a breathtaking experience for you if you actually read the unbelievable things that both of these people said under oath, given who they are.
Well, Mark Dankoff, thank you so much for coming on. We'll look forward to your next appearance here on National Bugle Radio.
I'll be ready, sir. Thank you for having me.
Thank you.